Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Podcast-Folge aus der Kölner Philharmonie. Ich bin Kathi Knees und ich bin mal wieder sehr gespannt auf meinen heutigen Gast. Er kommt aus den Niederlanden, ist nicht nur Komponist, sondern auch gelernter Toningenieur, Gitarrist, Theaterregisseur und er hat auch noch Film in New York studiert. Wenn wir alles besprechen, was er gemacht hat oder was er macht, dann wird das sicher die längste Podcast-Aufnahme, die wir je aufgenommen haben. Am 21. März, da wird sein Book of Water in der Kölner Philharmonie aufgeführt. Ein komplexes Werk, das er als Chamber Music Theater bezeichnet. Was genau das ist, das finden wir nun heraus. Hartelijk welkom, Michel van der A.
Hello.
So nice that you find the time between all of your projects. Are you a good time manager?
I have two kids. They're 15 and 16 now. And since they were born, I kind of had to... Yeah, I had to use my time very efficiently and I don't procrastinate anymore. It's, I kind of learned that the hard way.
And do you have a strict timeline for all your projects? Do you have it on the wall, pinned on the wall, and then everything is going according your plan?
I work with I have a foundation called the AA Foundation, and the foundation produces my work. We are a part of a subsidy system here in Holland, and therefore always have to think up our plans 4 years ahead. So I know now what I will do until 2028, which is on one side great, but on the other side, of course, a disaster because you're completely locked in what you think you'll do. But that also gives me sort of the possibility to really plan ahead quite far and make sure I reserve these blocks for these projects. And over the last sort of years, I've became a bit better at that and sort of finding enough time for all these elements and these pieces.
And how does it work, for example, for your Book of Water that will be... for the first time on a German stage in March. How does it work from your first idea to do something like that? Did you read the book of Max Frisch?
Yes.
Der Mensch erscheint im Holozän, and then you had the idea of bringing it to stage?
Yeah, I think the book was gifted to me about 15 years ago by a friend, and he said, well, this is something which really you should do something with. And I read it back then and really loved it. I didn't have a very concrete idea back then, but I sort of parked it in my brain. And then during COVID, during all the lockdowns, I thought, well, we're all so isolated now in our houses. And I sort of had to think about this book again. About this man Geiser in the book, who he's a widower and he's like 73 years old, lives in a small mountain village in Switzerland, and all his surroundings are blocked because of a snowstorm, and he's sort of locked into his house. And the book is has a wonderful structure. He basically makes notes for himself and puts these notes on the walls because you gradually start to notice that he's forgetting things. There's something not completely, he doesn't feel like himself. And you see all these notes are also printed in the book. And at the end of the book, you find out he actually had a stroke. This is the reason why he's so... fervently is trying to get grasp on what he knows and what he doesn't know anymore. So the book sort of plays with that, with the snippets they're printing on the pages. Yeah, so this aspect of isolation and of sort of getting into terms with your own mortality and especially your mental health, forgetting things, he really struggles with that, being a very intelligent man and sort of always, he sort of keeps on repeating what he does still know. So all the facts in the book about the Holocene, about dinosaurs, about aspects of climate. And for me, it's also, it was written in the 80s. It's also very much a climate change book, more on the background, but this is also something that really appealed to me, that behind his windows, it's terrible weather, there are landslides, And it's, and also in the references he makes in the book, you realize that the surroundings are changing where he lives. And I mean, so these two things, this isolation and this sort of climate aspect, sort of made me decide to write a music theater piece about it in when I was locked into my house during COVID.
And then you decided, I have to put these film elements to it and have two actors with different ages, one on the stage and one in the film, and a string quartet. Do you, when you develop a project like that, do you do it just by yourself, or do you talk about that?
I work with a wonderful dramaturg, Madeleine Koyman. I've been working with her a few years now, so we kind of develop together, and she does a lot of research, and we have a lot of meetings and talk about it after having read the book. One thing that I knew from the get-go is that I wanted to make the location of the house and the situation a little bit more generic. So I took it away from Switzerland and placed it into, it's a sort of solitary house in the rain somewhere in the northern Holland. Also, I made the focus on the climate and what's happening outside of his house a little bit bigger. I really love the juxtaposition of the environment, sort of wanting to come in through his windows, and the landslides around him, and his tomato plants are all sort of washed out, and he tries to recover them. And on the other hand, his mind is also eroding. So the world is eroding around him, the climate is eroding, but his mind is eroding. I thought it was a beautiful parallel that I wanted to shine a light on.
But these complex ideas that you have, how to bring your ideas on stage, you discuss it from the beginning with your dramaturg, or is there a phase of this intimate process of developing an idea just by yourself?
Yeah, I do a lot myself, which is great because I can really make sure that the music and the staging and the film really connect to each other and extend each other, but it's also very healthy not to do it all by myself, because I need people to ask me difficult questions and point me to flaws in my thinking. So that's why a designer or a dramaturg or a conductor, there's always people in the artistic team that I really invite to participate in the creation process. And it's also, I love working together. It would be very lonely, sad occupation is if I can only be here in my room behind my piano.
So now we have a chamber music theater, but there are also film operas or virtual reality installations that you made or you will make. Is this a kind of answer for you to the traditional opera projects?
Start from the libretto or the text or the idea of the piece, and then think, okay, how am I going to translate this to an audience? What do I need for that? And sometimes I need a string quartet, an actor, and some film screens, and sometimes I need an orchestra, and sometimes I need a solo singer. So it really depends on the idea. And also the use of film, I think it can be very powerful, but it can also be tricky. I mean, I never want to use my films as a backdrop to entertain people. It also always is a layer in itself and sort of reflects on the world, the physical world on stage. So there are certain, fundamental starting points for me that I always cherish, and when I read the book, I thought a lot about what's the best vehicle to present this to an audience. It's a very intimate story, so I didn't want to go too big. So I thought, well, a string quartet would be a good or a musical size for it. And I already quite early knew that I wanted to split the main character, the Geiser character, between the film and the stage. And my dream was to do it with a father, an actual father and a son that look a lot like each other. And I've been working with Samuel West on another project, The Book of Disquiet, Das Buch der Unruhe, that I did for Linz, Cultural Capital, way back then. Originally starring Klaus Maria Brandauer, and then I did the English version with Samuel. So I asked him, okay, do you want to be involved? And can you ask your dad to also be involved? Because his dad is a very famous English actor, now in his 80s. I think he's 89 now. So they both said yes. And we shot the film with Timothy West, and the live version is done by Samuel West.
That sounds exciting. Do you develop all these different layers at the same time, or do you have a phase that you concentrate on the film and then first comes the music and then you concentrate on which character will be on stage and which will be in the film?
No, it happens at the same time. And this is also important for me because then I can, for each scene, choose where the focus should be on. Is it a music, purely musical scene with voice, or are we sort of moving a little bit more to the film layer now? I can always change the weights of these layers depending on what the libretto asks at that point. So it's a constant play of changing perspectives, and being able to do that myself, I can already decide that while writing the music and thinking about the film script and thinking about the staging. So these three lines I develop at the same time.
And when you went to New York to study film, after you learned to compose and after you worked as a sound engineer and after you learned to play guitar, when you went to New York to concentrate on film, did you have on your mind already to put it all together on an opera stage?
Yes. I mean, I always have been very visual since I was a child. I love the visual element of music as much as the audible element. And also during my first compositions, more and more sort of ideas came up, not only how things should sound, but also how they should look like, how the musicians should behave on stage. The lighting on stage, all these things that for me are an important element of the ritual of a concert. And this element became bigger and bigger. And I thought, okay, I have to really do something with this and wanted to study film and in order to use it in a good way. And I found out that making film is quite similar to composing. You're dealing with time, you're making an editing of the film like you're doing with the musical material. So I felt quite comfortable in that new direction. And the education at the Film Academy in New York was wonderful. It was a 1-year sort of high pressure course where already in the first week they sent you on the streets with a camera and you had to sort of it was very hands-on, and you had to rotate through the film team. So you not only had to direct, but also be a cameraman, be a sound man, be a gaffer, put the lights in the right places. So you kind of learn about all these aspects of filmmaking in a very condensed way, which was a wonderful opportunity. And also to be in New York, which is one of my favorite cities, gave me a lot of energy and inspiration.
I watched some of the making-ofs of your projects on YouTube, and it was really fascinating to see you work and to see everybody on behind stage work for the project. Is this making-of process as important for you as the result later, or even more important?
I mean, in the end, it's about the final piece, of course. I mean, that's what we all work towards, but I really enjoy the creation process. I really enjoy collaboration so much. I get so much ideas and inspiration and energy from it. And I over the years, I sort of found a number of collaborators that I keep working with. They're all, I think, important for me is that they are open-minded and think in possibilities and not in problems. And because often my work, also on technical level, is quite quite an adventure. And I love when people get energy in diving in with me and trying to find a way to make that all work.
Yeah, I understand that there's a great interest of yours in technology, but also in this natural sounds, for example, in breaking a stick. What do you love about the sound of breaking wood?
Breaking a stick or breaking a twig, I think it's the most beautiful sound in the world. I used it in a very early work back in 2000 or something. What I love about it is that it's sort of a very analog primal sound. You know, I think when we hear it behind us, our primal instincts think, okay, there's danger, there's an animal sneaking up on us. So I love that sort of analog, very primal aspect of it. But also it's very electric. It sounds like a spark. It sounds like something very electrical. And I love the symbolism of it. I mean, also visual and theatrical, it's a beautiful thing to do. So in a way, it became an icon for my work, and because it sort of layers the analog and the electric and the visual in one snap. So I've been using it in every piece since then. There's always a sample or an actual breaking branch. In my violin concerto, there's no electronics, but the percussionists break branches on their knees. So in every piece, it happens. Sometimes very subtly and sometimes more prominently, but it's always there.
Yeah, I thought that maybe Janine Jansen could break her bow at the end of the concert. But is it harder to compose a violin concerto just for a violin and orchestra, but not as complex as with film and everything around? Is it harder or is it easier?
I mean,
to
it's
write?
A very different piece, and I love to work with Janine. I mean, the thing that inspired me was Janine. I mean, if she would have played recorder, I would have written a recording concerto. I mean, she's such an amazing performer. Like Sol Gambetta is also an amazing performer. I mean, if I'm really inspired by a soloist, that's what pulls me in, and that's what wants me to to write for them. And in that sense, writing a violin concerto is the same challenge as writing an opera. It's just a different vocabulary, you know, and the ideas I had for this piece were ideas I wanted to do with the violin and an orchestra and not with electronics or not with something else. That's why it's so wonderful not to be bound to one medium or not to be bound by one, you know, form. I love to be able to switch between an ensemble piece or an orchestral piece and a VR piece, and so that's a wonderful, that keeps me on my toes.
And when you look back and think about the young Michelle that got to know opera with the children's opera company of his parents, did you know as a child that your way would be like that?
I for sure my love for theater and for musical theater was born back then, and I think it always stayed with me. And also while only composing, I always had these visual ideas with it. And so I definitely, I think it definitely planted the seeds that eventually would have to come out. And I still believe, I mean, musical theater, opera, it's such an amazing thing to do. I mean, you're with maybe a team of 60 people in a dark box, and you create something together, and then this opening night and the audience comes in, and I always hate that the audience comes in, because the whole process of making something together and in this creating this whole new world together, that's such a magical thing.
Do you sometimes have doubts in the process of developing something, or are you so full of energy and believe that there's no doubt ahead?
Oh, there's always doubts, and I mean, every piece has its phases that I think, oh my God, I have to, why am I doing this? And this is something that started on my first composition, and it's still the same. There are still the same insecurities, still the same struggle against yourself. I mean, every day you have to sort of get out of bed, make many coffees, and start composing. And, you know, I know that everybody who works for themselves will recognize themselves in it, but it's sometimes very difficult to get yourself going and to, especially when you have to create something that doesn't exist yet. I mean, there's so many excuses for you not to do it or to, you know, to shove away an idea and think and sort of end in a panic state. And but I mean, I've basically these difficult moments during the process are always there, and I kind of came to recognize them for what they are. They're part of the process, and the only way to get through them is to keep going, really. And there's no such thing as waiting for inspiration, in my opinion. It's just, you have to make your hours, and you have to throw away everything that's not good. And at one point, can be behind your desk, can be while you're brushing your teeth or under the shower, you suddenly know it. This one thing that was missing, this one angle, this one idea that sort of becomes the fundament of the whole piece. It's very strange. I mean, you can work for a week, and then suddenly in 10 seconds during brushing your teeth, you can have more output than that whole week of composing.
Do you write on music paper, the pen, or do you use the computer?
Both. I mean, in an early stage of a piece, I spent quite a lot of time behind the piano and writing sort of the DNA, musical DNA of the piece. But when I do work with electronics, I have to move to the computer and start combining these things. And especially when working with the film often is very much timed to the music. So yeah, then I need to go behind the computer screen to fix all that.
And when you come to Cologne now with your Book of Water, will it be a different piece than before at a different place?
No, I don't think so. I think
is it easy to adapt to every location?
Yes, because we built like a black box around it, and we have our own set, and we use exactly the same staging and the same distances for the actor. So it should be approximately the same. He hasn't done it for a while, so it's going to be exciting for him. So we're going to have a fresh afternoon rehearsal and a lot of preparation in advance, but I'm sure he will do great.
And in your head, you're already processing with the next piece, I guess.
Oh yeah, there are many next pieces in my head. Yes, I'm working on a new VR opera called From Dust. This will be my next premiere in fall, and I've been. I'm collaborating with this wonderful German ensemble called Shaela, a vocal group with six singers. And we recorded their music a few weeks ago. And now we're working with a team of developers to create the rest of the virtual opera, basically.
Ah, and then everybody in the audience will have a VR?
It's glasses? No, it's, you have to go in one by one. So it's only one audience member at a time. Yeah.
Ah, that's interesting. Is it the first time you're doing something like that?
No, I've done another VR opera called 8. That was done a few years ago. Also performed in Germany at the Herrenhauser Festival. And basically, the audience has to sign in for a time slot, and then one by one they go in. And so it's a very very uncommercial project, quite terrible in that respect. But it's also an amazing experience to write for one audience member that actually is the protagonist in the piece. And in the case of From Dust, we we have an onboarding with the audience member, and the audience member is asked a bunch of questions about themselves, and we use these questions and the answers and their visual descriptions to create an experience that is really tailored only to them. So everybody sees her or his own version of this opera.
Do you think you have a totally different audience than the traditional opera or theater?
Partly, yeah, yeah. That's what we experienced before with Eight, my previous VR opera. A lot of people that are interested in VR or in VR art, and a lot of, I mean, I think the age is a little bit lower, which is good. So that's interesting to find new audiences that way.
But for you personally, is it an alternative to the traditional theater, or is it the next step that has to be done?
No, I mean it's a parallel possibility. I don't think it will replace anything. It's just for me a different. I mean, I can tell different type of stories like that, and stories that are written for an individual audience member, and that. Where the audience member actually is part of the narrative. You can do things in VR that you can't do in a physical stage. So it's an exciting outlet for me. On the other hand, I wouldn't only want to make VR operas. I'm also preparing a big new opera for next year, for 26. So that will be in a house again with an orchestra, with singers, and yeah.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here with the Book of Water, an exciting project to have in the Kölner Philharmonie.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be in Cologne again. I have very wonderful working relationship with the Philharmonie, and I'm very happy that we can do this new step in our collaboration.
And thank you so much for your time today. Thanks a lot, and we're happy to having you here.
Yeah, looking forward.
Ja, das war wieder eine Podcast-Folge aus der Kölner Philharmonie. Heute mit Kati Knees und Michel van der Aa. Vielen Dank. Tut's.